Lou Manfredini here. Do you have cracked or sunken concrete areas around your home? Call PermaSeal for a free estimate. Don't replace it, raise it. Call 800-421-7325 or visit permaseal.net.
This is Stellar Science.
It is. Hey there, Rod. How's everything with your Ad Astra tonight? Rod
Captain,
Pyle?
My captain. It's yes. Fine. I'm just setting the new issue into layout, and it'll be out in about 3 weeks.
With a whole bunch of stuff that I won't be able to understand?
Heavens no.
You're
the kind of person we write for, you know? A person who just loves science more than anything.
Indeed, I do.
Well,
no,
see?
I don't. No, I don't really. I mean, I like science fiction.
Yeah. Well, that's good enough for me. I mean, that's the gateway drug to what we do. Honestly.
It is.
So it is.
And you know what? You're right, because you watch these movies. Well, not just Star Wars and Star Trek, but you see something in that film that has got its basis in real science. And then you find out later that, oh, guess what? That thing you saw, that's a real thing. I know that happens on a variety of occasions. I can't remember exactly the examples I'm looking for, except, well, as long as I got on this ledge, I might as well not fall.
Let me give you a little push.
So, where does it go? Come on. Star Trek, the motion picture.
Yes.
As opposed to Star Wars
episode number 4.
Right. Star Trek, the motion picture has a scene in it. This is my favorite scene in that film. And I think it addresses a little bit of what I'm talking about.
V-G-E-R feature. V-O-I-A-G-E-R. Voyager.
NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
Oh, God.
I love that.
Voyager, yeah.
Yeah.
I love it, too, but, you know, that whole last act, and I'm jumping ahead a bit here, but that whole last act, remember we talked about Irving the Explainer last time?
Yeah.
And this was such, you know, this was a big concept movie, and it was pretty hardcore science fiction for that era, especially because we hadn't had many that weren't just kiddie films up to that point, except 2001, a handful of others.
Oh.
So here comes this big, hard science fiction written by a known and respected science fiction author originally, Alan Dean Foster. And so in this last act, we're scratching our heads so much. It's like, okay, let's all stand around this really cool set and explain what's going on so the audience can keep up with us. And I have to say, you know, it's kind of touching on what you're talking about in a more abstract way. It struck me towards the end there when V'ger is, you know, spoiler alert, refusing to accept the last transmission from Earth so it'll stop trying to fry the planet and all that.
Right.
The way it talks, I thought, this is just like talking to Siri on my iPhone. It's kind of circular logic where it's like, that does not compute. And I thought, yeah, see, they saw the future. That, you know, the risk communicator.
Yeah, you know. Well, I got one here, too. And that is, V'ger wanted one-to-one interaction. It didn't want to just get a communication.
That's true, but the scary part is, by the end of the movie, it's pretty clear what V'ger really wanted was an orgasm, and it was made of light. Wow. So I'm not quite sure what all that was about. Sorry, I got a little spicy there.
But okay.
Like, where are we going with this movie?
That's all right.
But I jumped ahead to the last act. That's wrong.
No. Well, the movie, I don't like the movie. I think the movie's sort of lame, quite frankly. I mean,
it
just sort of plods along, and you know,
you wound me.
I did.
Yeah, I'm with him. Sorry, John.
Look, here's the thing that happens in outer space. Something's gone wrong. Guess what? Captain Kirk's no longer the captain of the Kirkies, and he doesn't have a spaceship. So guess what? His ego's going to take over, and he's going to step in on another ship and take over. And guess what? He's bringing along all his pals, and away you go.
Yes, that's about it. I will add to your point, If you added up all the minutes of reaction shots in this movie driving through the V'ger parking lot, it's a lot of it. But I have to say, you know, having seen it in the theater probably 10 times when I was a kid. Well, I wasn't a kid actually at that point. Because I loved the visuals. Let's step back. You know, this is 1978.
The visuals were stunning for 1978.
And all that stuff's analog. Those are all physical models. And not only that, but you didn't even have computers to do compositing. So they would shoot the film, rewind it, shoot it again, rewind it, shoot it again. They do like 10 passes. Some of the frames of crawling through V'ger with the motion control camera, which is even slower than watching it on the film. Some of those frames were 90-second exposures, so they had to correct it so the smoke didn't look animated. I mean, just the incredible virtuoso performance of the effects guys in this movie, which went like three times over budget.
Right.
It was supposed to be $15 million, ended up at $44 is jaw-dropping to me. And same with Star Wars in a different way.
Well, one of the things that I like about the different versions of these iconic films. It's not so much the Star Wars films, because they pretty much confine themselves to a very excellent set of visuals and music. But when it comes to like the Star Trek theme, you know, I really get into how different
theme.
Music theme. I really get into the different arrangements that have been put into these different movies and TV series. And I got an example when we come back on 720 WGN. That's all. Just a little thing there, the way they got into it. You know, I got a kick out of that for some reason. Maybe it's just me. That's obviously Star Trek the Motion Picture. 20 minutes after 8 o'clock, John Landecker here at 720 WGN with Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, Stellar Science, Star Wars versus Star Trek. So it starts out, I mean, this is, 1979? Is that the correct year for?
I think it was 78.
Well, you would know better.
Maybe it was released in 79.
You would know better than I would.
It was, I mean, the effects shop, the first guys they hired, a company named Robert Able, had spent millions, which was a lot then. It's like $10 million now.
Sure.
All they got done was that wormhole at the beginning, that orange tunnel they go through. That's it. And they had spent the money. I mean, it depends on which rumors you listen to, but, you know, Cars and Spare Homes, I guess. So they ended up going to the same people that did Close Encounters and said, help. They worked triple shifts 7 days a week for months. Get this thing done. And just that V'ger set, again, you've got this camera, you know, that's rolling through it on this motion control rig, 70 feet long.
Yeah,
a bunch of stages. And one of the reasons they smoked it up so much was because they were still working on it when they were shooting and they wanted to occlude the background.
There's some things you got to hide that aren't quite ready yet.
Right.
So how much money did that movie make? Was it a big box office success?
Yeah, it did pretty well. Let's see.
I mean, I thought it was sort of, it got mixed reviews, if I remember correctly.
It did. When it came out, it kind of got whacked. And, you know, part of the problem was neither Paramount nor the public, I think, but especially Paramount as a studio, really knew what to do with this at first. You know, they had this series that was canned 10 years before for low ratings. But people wanted it back, so they said, okay, we'll make a Star Trek movie. And they worked on that for a couple of years, and they said, no, we hate these scripts we're getting from Roddenberry and these abstract science fiction writers that are eggheads. We'll make it a TV show, Star Trek Phase 2. And they went for that for a while, and they said, oh, look at Star Wars. That made a bunch of money. Okay, let's make a movie. So, you know, a lot of the money spent was before they rolled a single frame of the actual 70-millimeter Star Trek movie that they ended up shooting. But it did
The budget was $44 million, and according to Wikipedia, it made $139 million.
There we go. And that was probably in the first release cycle, right?
So
It doesn't specify.
Was the Wrath of Khan the one that followed this?
That was 1982.
That yeah, one, so that's a few right. years later. Right. Really tight budget, because Paramount turned around and said to the gang, okay, look, you guys like went triple over on this thing. That ain't happening again. No more Robert Wise. We're getting rid of Gene Roddenberry. Mm-hmm. We're going to hire other producers, and we're going to get Nicholas Meyer, who was at that time kind of an unknown director. He had done a couple of small things. And they told him, I think he wrote that script in like 12 days.
Wow.
Which is pretty remarkable. And they looked at it and said, great, done, first pass. And they shot that movie on a pittance. And
yeah,
for 12, a lot of people, 12 it's million. The best one that there ever was. Yeah.
12 yeah, million, it and it made $97 million at the box office.
Well, I think one of the reasons that it did as well as it did was because of the characters in it. I mean, they had some really powerful performances, wasn't it? Ricardo Montalban, was he?
Yes.
Ricardo Montalban. I mean, they had much better uniforms.
Yeah, and he was fantastic. I mean, he sold that part. I mean.
So he and Kirk never actually have a scene together in real life. You know, they were both talking to view screens. But, you know, it's like here you got Ricardo with that chest of his that was
real.
And he's in his 50s. And then you got William Shatner doing his thing. And it's like these two oversized Armstrong hams kind of strutting back and forth on the stage. Con Kirk, I'll curse your every breath, you know. But it was great theater, right? It was truly like Shakespeare.
Right.
And the effects were even better in that one. And it was the first
one of the series with computer-generated graphics.
Oh, really? It was
right.
That? Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Wrath of Khan.
And that whole, you know, if you go on YouTube and look at like best Star Trek effect shots in that era, that whole battle in the Mutara Nebula between the Reliant and the Enterprise comes straight out. And of course, I've talked about the Enterprise model before, but I'll just say it one more time.
Sure, go ahead.
I got to work with it for a weekend. It's 8 feet. It's perfect. And I looked it up today. It was $180,000 in 1978, which is just shy of $1 million now, which is why it was such a nice model. But if you remember when you're watching the movie, the one you just sat through, and, you know, Kirk's riding that little shuttle with Scotty and two actors that hated each other, by the way, as they're flying over to the Enterprise, they're going underneath it, and you see that pearlescent paint job and those little squares I was talking about last time we talked about Star Trek. Right. I mean, there was a guy who was known for being like the best airbrush painter in creation who sat there and those are like little one-inch squares, painted those by hand. This one goes left to right. This one goes top to bottom so that they'd pop as you go by. It was I almost cried when I saw that thing first time.
When you say you get to work with it or play with it, exactly what are you doing? What specifically? Well,
Paramount owned Simon & Schuster at that point. Yeah. So they were going to do a Star Trek book and they wanted a big cover shot, a double spread cover shot. So the guy I was working for, who was the effects producer on Deep Space Nine and TNG, he was one of the two effects supervisors. He and I drove out to, took a truck out to beautiful Pacoima, California, which is a place that nobody would miss if it got nuked. Sorry, Pacoima. And, you know, there's a reason Paramount stored all the crap out there because it's cheap. And so we went to the storage unit, opened this enormous crate, you know, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark, crowbars and the whole thing. And here's this incredible model sitting in a couple of mounts and a bunch of straw. And so we pulled it up, got it on the truck, took it back to the studio, and set it up to shoot this book cover. So the whole thing was just to shoot a book cover. Unfortunately, when we got there and put it all together, we realized the deflector dish was missing. So somewhere, at some point, when somebody was packing it up, probably somebody wanted a souvenir, and away it went. Mm-hmm. So we found another one that was half the size, so we had to like stick it halfway between the ship and the camera so it looked like it was sitting there properly. You know, I'll send you a picture of this sometime. Yeah,
that's some of the things that you have to do. I mean, there are ways to attain the effect that you want by sort of finding yourself in a situation where, oops, we're going to have to sort of MacGyver this thing, for lack of a better term, you know. And no one knows. We don't know. The audience has no idea. We're taking it at face value. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and what we were going through was nothing. I mean, when you, again, just going back to the kudos to these effects guys, the 70s and 80s, you know, they had to invent stuff every single day. Mm-hmm. And I was reading the, you know, when the Klingon ships get gobbled up at the beginning by V'ger,
yes,
that yep, Sparky yep thing.
Absolutely.
I always thought they animated that, but it turns out they got a huge Tesla coil. And these things run at like a million volts, you know. They're kind of dangerous. And set it up, and then they covered the Klingon ship, so they shot the Klingon ship plate, yeah, and then they covered it with tinfoil, and then put this Tesla coil up, and all these sparks are crawling all over it, and then they put those two things together. I don't know if they did them on the same piece of film in two passes, or if they shot it with an optical camera, because there are a couple of ways to do that, and got these great effects. But again, you know, there's some dangerous stuff going. You got all these high-powered lights around. You got this Tesla coil. I think at one point, the V'ger set was chewing up 178,000 volts, I read.
My.
I mean, this is like, you know, you have to bring in a line directly from the power plant down the street.
Right, exactly. Everybody so, in the neighborhood is noticing their lights are flickering.
Exactly. but you know what? I hear you. I mean, it was slow, and I just watched the director's cut, which I was trying to find the original version because it was all the effects from that era. The director's cut, the one they just put out a few years ago, they, you know, digitized some of it and cleaned it up. But it plods, that original cut,
it
especially.
Does.
The new one's a little tighter, but it does crawl along.
You know what it is? You know what it is? There's a lot of vanity shots that go on forever. Look at the ship they're using. Look at it come out of its dock. We're going to watch it and watch it and watch it because, I don't know.
Look at Ilea with her bald head.
Well,
right. Well, nice.
I'd rather look at that than
V'ger.
But I think, you know, I got to say, I think that somewhere in the process, Robert Wise didn't even know what Star Trek was and they hired him. You know, he had done West Side Story, Dave Ear Stood Still, lots of other big movies. But literally, he had seen like three episodes, so they had to get him like film reels of 18 episodes for him to get it. But somewhere in that unit of director, producers, all that, I think they sort of became in awe of what they were doing and almost overly faithful to it. So it's like, oh, we got to show this. We got to show this. The fans will love that. And it's like, no, you need to kind of start getting out the scissors.
Right. Sometimes,
I don't need to see Sulu staring at the camera, at the green screen again for 10 minutes.
Sometimes less is more. We're going to break. We're going to do more. It's the bottom of the hour. Time to get into the WGN newsroom.
We'll be with you. Always.
Thank you, Obi-Wan. 720 WGN, John Landecker along with Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. Stellar Science. That's what we're doing with Star Wars and Star Trek. We were about at the last half hour to Star Trek, so equal time for Star Wars, I believe, would be appropriate.
Help me, John Landecker. You're my only hope. Oh, sorry. You know, so I have to say, I had kind of been dismissive of Star Wars over the last 30 years, so I sat down and watched it afresh, and everything about it was much better than I remembered, which doesn't happen very often.
Right. No, I agree. I watched
and they it nailed it, and, man.
Oh, totally. I mean, the plot, the characters that were, you know, of another world, like that cantina place. I mean, the lasers, you know, the force be with you. I mean, we're talking some things that like became permanently ingrained in, you know, come to the dark side, Luke. You know what I mean? It's just like really great stuff.
And it's got this universal appeal that I don't quite understand, I have to admit. I think I missed it by about 10 years. People a little younger than me really got nailed by this film. But, you know, all these very kind of classic slash corny tropes put together is a little bit like Independence Day for me. It's a bunch of corny old stuff that just worked, and the actors weren't the best, but they just worked together. And it was, the budget was $8.2 million, which is just under $50 million today. And it ended up at $11 million, which is just under $61 million a day. But it made record revenues and ran in a number of theaters for a year continuously, which I thought was astonishing.
It was a total phenomenon. I mean, it became a thing. It wasn't just a hit. Wasn't just a movie that was a hit. It was. It took over everything and never stopped, quite frankly. I mean, there have been so many different Star Wars-related movies over the years. I mean, generations have passed, and I think they sort of lost me along the way. You know what I mean?
Because they did me too. And I think
I was there in the beginning. And it's fine that, you know, there's some fresh material for people who are getting into it now. You know what I mean? But we were there when it started. So
I'm going to make a boomer comment here, okay?
Oh, sure.
I think, you know, I watched the newer ones, and the plot to me kind of gets lost in all the computer graphics, which ends up making it feel like a video game.
Right.
And I kind of wonder if the fact that it's become an awful lot easier to sit and create that stuff electronically in a box than it was to do it analog with plywood and nails and smoke and all that lighting. You know, maybe something in the changing of that process kind of caused them to lose the theme. But I wanted to take a minute and step into alternate reality land for a second.
Please do.
So two of the titles that they apparently were going with when Lucas was developing this early on, the early one was Adventures of the Starkiller, Episode 1, The Star Wars. And the character was Luke Starkiller instead of Starwalker. Later title was The Adventures of Luke Starkiller is taken from the Journal of the Wills Saga, Saga 1, The Star Wars. Alternative casting for Luke could have been Kurt Russell or Charles Martin Smith. Ooh. For Leia, Karen Allen or Jodie Foster. But my favorite, for Han Solo, they looked at James Caan, Chevy Chase, Jack Nicholson, Robert De Niro, Sylvester Stallone, and John Travolta, Burt Reynolds.
Well, there's a lot of talent there, but you know, the selections that they made, it's impossible to imagine anybody else playing those parts. I mean, Harrison Ford is Han Solo, man. I mean,
he's incredible.
It's just like the way it is. And Carrie Fisher was the Princess Leia, and Mark Hamill was Luke Skywalker, and that's that. I mean, I thought they had it nailed as far as that was concerned. There was one thing, I watched it again, and it's been this way the entire time, and it's a compliment to them who made it, in the sense that there's so much dialogue from characters who have things on their head. That you can't see, well, how about stormtroopers? How about,
well, that's why they can't hit anything, because they're looking through those goofy helmets.
But you hear their dialogue. I'm Darth Vader, for instance. Hello. I mean, and you believe that he's evil, and he is, but, and that's James Earl Jones. But here's something that's totally cloaked, so to speak. You can't see the face. There's no facial expression to convey any kind of emotion, yet you buy in 100%, which I thought was, I hadn't thought of that until I was watching it just a couple of days ago.
And that's a really interesting point.
I'm suddenly realized, like, look, I mean, even C-3PO, I mean, he's got a face that's artificial, but none of his features move. I mean, his arms and his legs move fine.
Yeah.
But his
face is locked. Face, you're right. It's almost like puppetry. Yeah.
Exactly. And any of these stormtroopers are talking to each other. And it's like, that must be true because they have communication devices inside those crazy helmets.
You know?
And especially, I'm repeating myself now, but especially Darth Vader. Man, you never see his face. You don't know if he has lips. I mean, he doesn't have any facial expressions, but he doesn't need them. And I thought that was an achievement of some kind, and I'm not quite sure what you call it.
I think I call it making him look like a Nazi.
You do have something that has sparked my curiosity. James Earl Jones was the voice.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't they just let him be Darth Vader?
Wasn't tall enough.
Yeah, because the guy who played Darth was tall, and I suspect maybe he didn't really feel like standing around in that costume for 14 hours a day.
Yeah, okay. Why go to work and do it and spend all day? Because
when you finally see, I think it's in the third film, you finally see him without his helmet on as he's dying.
He looks like an accountant.
Yeah,
how disappointing was it? It's like with a melted head.
It's like, okay, we have this voice of God.
Yeah,
and then that's what he looks like.
Well, and once you see his face, you expect him to go, "Look, come over here. I feel terrible."
But the thing is, up until then, I mean, why would James Earl Jones want to spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on a set?
Because they probably would have paid him as much as he wanted to do it.
I think they paid him as much as he wanted already. I mean, all he's got to do is go into a recording studio and lay down the vocal tracks and he's done for the
day. And credit to him, you know, so often, I mean, you've heard voiceovers on movies before.
Sure.
Like when they, you know, when they have to augment the soundtrack or when they're dubbing something foreign, 90% of the time, it sounds like a guy sitting in a studio trying to sound dramatic.
Right.
But James Earl Jones inhabited that helmet virtually and made that character just sing.
And the way that they altered his voice also played a great deal in...
Oh, that was a scuba regulator. Yeah.
Yeah. More when we come back on 720 WGN.
Faith disturbing.
Yes, he does.
Don't you wish you could do that?
Yeah, I do.
Yes.
I'll bet there's somebody in the studio that you wish you could turn around and hold your hand.
It is just, it's too much. I mean, it's fantastic.
It is great. And it was so clever. And the thing was, you know, I mean, there are a lot of differences between these movies. This is more of a fairy tale, Star Trek's deep science fiction.
Right.
You know, this is the hero's journey and so forth. But there was humor in Star Wars. It was fun to watch. Now, I have a short announcement I have to make. I just got a series of texts from my lovely ex-wife, who plays in the Los Angeles Philharmonic. It said, "Hey, the music made it. It was John Williams. You can't believe how powerful John Williams's music is. You cannot believe the roar of the crowd when we play that first chord of Star Wars at a symphony concert."
So they did that? Wait a minute. Hold on a second. This is your ex-wife?
Yeah. We're pals.
And she plays for whom?
The L.A. Philharmonic. And every year, at least once, they do a John Williams concert. And so hear that downbeat for Star Wars. The crowd
so did they
wild.
Just did they just do one?
I don't know that it was.
Or is she listening?
Recently. Oh, she's listening, yeah.
Oh, good.
20th century box.
Wrong one. Wrong one. Hold on. Way to go, John. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. John Williams is a genius. I mean,
yeah.
Take a look. Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. And these are like iconic
almost pieces of music. Almost every film score that he has written has turned out to be just overpowering.
You know, I would love to hear, you mentioned your ex-wife in an orchestra. I'd love to hear that in a concert. That would be
You gotta go.
Do they ever I mean, I've seen this
Chicago
where they show the film, but if they've taken out the soundtrack and the soundtrack's performed by the orchestra, which is below the actual film as it goes on.
But that's, leave the dialogue up.
That's been done.
I know it's been done. That's what I'm just saying.
We thought asking us.
No, I'm just saying I wish I had gone to one of those. I mean, that's gonna be fantastic.
I mean, part of what I think the appeal to Williams is, especially for our generation, is that it's very orchestral. It's kind of 19th century music. And I have to hand it to Jerry Goldsmith in Star Trek and a bunch of other movies he did, because he scored, you know, dozens of movies, because he wrote more to the film in a way. And I'm not saying that John Williams didn't do a brilliant job on Star Wars.
Right.
But it's a bit like listening to a series of 19th century classical music concerts, which I love, by the way. Goldsmith, I felt, wove the score a bit more deeply into the film with something like Star Trek or Wind in the Lion or something like that, you know?
Wind in the Lion. You know the Wind in the Lion?
Oh,
frame. Are you a fan of the Wind in the Lion?
Mostly because...
That is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Well, and the guy that played Teddy Roosevelt makes me cry.
Brian...
Because I want that president, Brian Keith.
Yeah. Brian Keith. I've never talked to anybody about The Wind and the Lion.
I just want to be alone with my bear.
I just thought it was something that I was into. It's got John Connery as an Arab, which is like...
Which is weird, but it works, right?
Do you want to hear just a few of the movies he did the scores for?
Sure.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Right.
Schindler's List. Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Are you talking about John Williams?
Yeah. Indiana Jones and all the Indiana Jones movies. All of them. Yeah. Hook, Jurassic Park, Empire of the Sun, Amistad, Lost World, Jurassic Parks, Amistad. Saving Private Ryan.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
They probably prefer we not mention Hook, though.
Yeah, probably not. The same for Popeye. It's like both. Never happened. We know nothing.
So that's a... wait a minute. Hold on a second. Wait.
Yeah.
You say it. Man, I still get... I get chills all the... I don't know. I watch that movie at least every year.
I heard nothing during that slug, so I don't know what you're talking about.
You didn't hear the music?
No.
Why is that?
I don't know. I was panicking. I thought, oh my God, we dropped our signal.
Were we on the air? I heard it.
What were you playing?
Well, anyway, I played the Jerry Goldsmith part of the theme from Wind in the Lion. How about Candace Bergen in that movie?
Oh my God. Yeah.
He's the great Raizuli. It's just
the great Raizuli. Raizuli. Master of the Rift.
Sultan to the Berbers.
You should take a spin through YouTube. Don't get too deep, but just type in John Williams and see how many things pop up with him as guest conductor.
But I challenge you to type in Jerry Goldsmith and listen to some of his, A Patch of Blue back in the 60s, I think it was. Planet of the Apes. And Planet of the Apes in particular was this weird kind of discordant, weird percussion score. I mean, he did some really daring stuff for the time. And the score for Star Trek, if you look at the value-added stuff on the director's cut, the first version he turned in was at a jazz tempo. And apparently the director, Robert Wise, had the same reaction I did, which is, if you don't take that off, I'm going to throw up and throw you out of the room.
Do you know that Williams wrote the music for some of the episodes of Lost in Space?
Yes, I do.
I did not.
And he was Johnny Williams.
Hey, listen, I know that The Wind and the Lion is not a sci-fi movie, but... I'd love to do a half hour on that with you on the air, man.
Sure.
Okay.
That'd be.
It's not sci-fi, but it's...
Now we'll have to record a new opener. We could do adventures. We could do that in Jurassic Park.
And, okay.
The great adventure movies.
You want to do that next week?
I'll do anything you want, brother.
Or did you have something planned?
He did a couple of Harry Potter flicks too.
Let's
not talk about Harry Potter.
Okay,
that's. I'm going off. We should stay on the sci-fi thing. I'll do that.
Okay.
Wind of the Lion.
One more alternative reality?
Please do.
At one point, apparently, Luke Skywalker was thought to be a woman, which they kind of did in the later movies.
Really?
They thought they'd cast a woman. But my favorite part is apparently one, and you got to give Lucas credit for thinking outside the box. At one point, he thought, "I want the entire main cast to be midgets." Little people.
Excuse me?
God. I thought, huh.
Really?
Well, wow. I mean, I guess if you know, I mean, this is my not doing particularly deep research, but you could imagine if he's thinking, okay, this is off Earth, it's a time far away in a different galaxy, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay.
Well, you know, that's where Star Wars lost me in the movies that whatever those creatures were jumping around in the trees. And you know, wherever they got really like cutesy little teddy bear stuff, I'm like, what are you doing? Come on.
The third movie, right?
Yeah.
Teddy Bear Wars. I just wanted
Please.
For me, that would be a good shooting gallery. You just wipe out the, what are they called? Not the Yodas. What are they called?
Ewoks?
Ewoks.
Like, yeah.
Ewok. Wasn't that an awful film? No, they were the Ewoks. No. And you had to look at that and think, and this is before Disney owned it, obviously, but you had to look at that and think, oh, they're thinking of product development and branding.
Yes, no
doubt.
So
they could sell those, damn teddy bears.
How many kids will want one of those? Ugh. Yeah.
Oh, I just wanted one so I could burn it. Yeah. that was not a good look. And it took them a while to kind of get their mojo back. And then I think it was the first prequel that they did. Isn't that the one where Anakin decides he's having a bad afternoon, so he goes and murders a village or something?
You know what? I don't remember that distinctly. This is when they started to lose me as a regular, you know. I'm like, you know, I think I've seen a lot of this before.
Although a lot of people say that a couple of the more recent TV series have been pretty incredible.
Yeah, I should probably go back and take a look at that. They've got some great actors in there, which is also a plus. Well, I loved it.
We've done it again.
Yep, and I can't wait to do it again. Oh, but do you have any, what are we doing again? What are we doing on the next one?
Oh, I'll reach out to Jack and we'll come up with something. Okay. Like we always do, sort of.
Of course you do. And Ad Astra Magazine, put in a plug. Come on.
Yes, Ad Astra Magazine, published by the National Space Society. Every quarter, go to nss.org for more information, because it's not only the best space magazine on the newsstand, it's the last space magazine on the newsstand. So give it a check. It's all pretty cool. And we're priced at least $3 below the competition. Well, there is no competition, but below other magazines. We keep
all right, Rod. Thank you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Good weekend. Yep.
Take care.
Rod Pyle, Ad Astra Magazine, editor-in-chief.